What is up? Welcome to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd, my co-host. He's Thomas Drance. He covers the Canucks for The Athletic as well. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And this hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. You need forklifts that perform under pressure and pallet racking that maximizes your space. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Drance, what's going on, man?
Oh, not much. Had a great weekend. Really enjoyed myself. Nice to be back in the city.
What made it so great?
I was just
not
nice
that
to
I'm
be
skeptical. It's just, you know, I'm curious.
So, I'm going to be honest with you. So I was at an all-inclusive for a destination wedding.
Very nice.
And I don't know, do you know this about me? Do you know that I'm like a really grumpy human being?
Yes, I do. I did know that about you.
So I...
Sportsnet 650, breaking news.
So I'm a grumpy guy.
Yeah.
Just a grumpus. And all-inclusives, I don't want to be like overly dramatic here.
Okay.
But for me, I might as well be in prison. I can't stand it.
What about it?
I hate the buffet. I hate the quality of the booze. I hate the slow service. I hate the amount of people that are around. I hate being in a place where, like, we were in a place where it wasn't, like, super safe to go around town.
Boo-hoo. I was stuck in an all-inclusive in Jamaica.
I hated it. I love my family. I was so glad to be there to support them, and I had a great time with the people I was there with. But all-inclusives get me down.
So I've heard similar. I've been to one all-inclusive in my life, and I had a good time. I enjoyed it.
Well, you're a simple
swim
man.
Swim up bar. We had the thing could like.
I feel like I'm going to get a rash at the swim.
We had the thing where you could like swim right out of your room. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, I like that.
I like
that's
that.
Nice.
That was cool.
That's a good feature.
I enjoyed that a lot. I think it was the Holly Holm Ronda Rousey fight I watched in the sports bar. That was awesome. That was fun.
That's sick. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed watching the end of the Leafs Panthers series with a bunch of Leafs fans. That was hilarious.
That's a good one.
I had a really good bit going where I'd tell all their partners about how Leafs fans are the worst. You know what I mean? I'd be like, this is why Leafs fans are the worst. And I'd go into it. I'd be like, no matter what happens, they'll blame Marner.
Yep. Yeah.
They talk about Matthew Knies like he's their son. He can do no wrong, whether he does well or not.
The next Mikko
everything
Rantanen.
Is the referee's fault. Literally, every single thing is the referee's fault. They have no clue that their team's just not good enough. And so I'd build this narrative about why Leafs fans are the worst, and then inevitably someone would be like, Marner! Or like, Nice! What a great play! That was fun. I enjoyed that.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad you could find it. I've heard similar complaints about cruise ships. I've never been on a cruise, but I've heard very similar complaints about that.
I'm not a big cruise ship guy, I will say, because, again, I don't like being confined. But I do like, the thing about a cruise ship that I like is if you're going on a big family trip with, like, I have memories of going on those ones, you know, when they relocate from Vancouver to L.A.?
Yes.
And you get the budget. We used to do that with my grandmother, like, toward the end of her life when she wasn't that mobile. And she always had a blast. So I like remember them fondly because they were good for her.
Fair enough.
So I would say if you have like a large family, including people with mobility issues, a cruise ship's a pretty decent way to get everyone together.
All right. Glad we had that check-in. 650,
so,
650.
Anyway, my weekend was great because I was home.
I ate my own food. I drank my own wine.
I enjoyed myself. I did whatever I wanted. I walked around. Whew.
Congratulations.
We have a great city, people.
What a thrill. We sure do.
Yeah.
Okay. To the matter at hand. And there's a lot to get into today.
Is there?
Well, there is. I mean, we're actually serving as the kind of the pregame show for a big winner-take-all game, the Abbotsford Canucks and the Colorado
That's
Eagles.
True. That's big.
We'll do a little bit of that at some point, but they play at 2 o'clock this afternoon, right after our show. But really, in the NHL.
We carrying it live?
We are. Yeah.
Nice. Love it.
So we'll transition right from our show to the call with Brandon Astle here on the station. But in the NHL, all signs right now, and I don't want to bury the Dallas Stars just yet. I'm fine with burying the Hurricanes, but all signs point to a Stanley Cup final rematch as Florida and Edmonton look in complete control of their series. I know it's only 2-1.
Do you think so?
So for me, and I think we talked about this last week, where people looked at the Dallas comeback in game one as evidence of kind of that explosiveness and the some of the cracks in Edmonton, which is fair to an extent, but I also, like, you couldn't ignore the fact that it was all in the power play, and you're just not going to keep getting those opportunities. So that was always the reason for doubting Dallas, and then the way the next two games have played out, I'm not saying it's impossible. Again, I don't want to bury them. They're not in as dire straits as Carolina, but Edmonton is the heavy, heavy favorite, obviously, up 2-1 in this series with another home game on tap to advance at this point.
Yeah.
Like, it overwhelmingly, the most likely scenario here is our Stanley Cup Finals rematch.
So, I actually thought Dallas played their best game of the series last night. I thought they gave Edmonton a lot, all they could handle, especially in that second period. And to me, it was one of those weird ones where the game breaks on a couple key moments. Like, they miss, obviously, the Kulak puck over glass, and immediately Edmonton scores on their next two shifts. That was a huge turning point. And then 3-1 early in the first period, right? Well, first of all, it's late in the second period, you've got Mikko Rantanen with Granlund and Robertson. I thought their area game, because that's a new line with Roope Hintz out, I thought their area game and their ability to sort of control play below the hash marks, almost like Miller, Besser, Pugh Suter, like a higher-end version of what the Canucks had last year in the postseason. I thought they were monsters down low. Granlund ends up hitting that post, the one that hit the post, and then Stuart Skinner's elbow, and then the post again. So they weren't quite rewarded late in the second. And then in the third, they have that wild goal mouth scramble. I'm pretty sure Skinner got his stick on it. And then the puck goes the other way. Great feed by Ryan Nugent-Hopkins to Zach Hyman. And boom, 4-1. And it's just like, in all of those moments, that game can break one way or the other. And it just happened to go Edmonton's way, in my mind. I think Jake Oettinger is a problem, though. Like, where's the... Connor Hellebuck gets lit up on the road, people. Now, where is all those folks walking it back? I mean, honest, fair comment, don't you think? If that's Hellebuck's issue, because there were a lot of softies last night.
Yep.
And the problem with Edmonton too is that sometimes it's hard to diagnose the softies because it's still being fired by Connor McDavid. You know what I mean? So it's like, well,
it's Connor McDavid. What are you going to do?
Yeah. It's still lightly screened and a wrist shot that he didn't even place right. Like, you know, it's not perfect placement. It's a good shot. It's not a great shot. Anyway, respect to Connor McDavid. What a great player he is. And so much fun to watch that series play out. Anyway, I think Dallas is perfectly live. I mean, they're in trouble. I picked Edmonton to win this series going into it. Stuart Skinner is massively outplaying Jake Oettinger, which is a problem, but also a problem that I don't think we expect to continue. Right? Like, I wouldn't necessarily take that to the bank.
No.
And so I'm really excited for game four. What a massive difference, by the way. You watch the Eastern Conference Final and then the Western Conference Final? Oh, boy.
Yeah. And
the difference in how engaged I am in those games, how much I need a second screen.
The Eastern Conference Final, we'll see how it plays out tonight if they complete the sweep. It's going to go down as one of the most, at this stage of the playoffs, one of the most lopsided results in recent history, right? To get to this stage and you think, hey, like, because people made fun of Rod Brind'Amour for the sweep a couple years ago where he was like, it wasn't really a sweep. And he didn't choose his words perfectly, but there was a bunch of overtime games.
He was right.
There was a bunch of overtime games in that. So you get at least what he was saying, the point he was trying to make. This is just a completely different animal, a completely different thing where you are getting dominated, outclassed in every possible way. You're getting embarrassed at this stage and you don't see it that much. Quite like this at this stage of the playoffs, right? Like, this is more a round one or round two thing to see. And
we have to normalize, by the way, in talking about hockey in the playoffs, that, like, you can take a team to game seven the way the Canucks did against the Oilers last year, and it's not actually close. Like, anyone actually paying attention knew that those were not the same caliber of team, right? No one would argue it today, but also no one should have been arguing it the day after game seven. You know, that Toronto Florida series is another good example where it makes it to seven, wasn't close. That was like a blowout seven. And then you'll have, the Senators almost lost in five to the Maple Leafs, three overtime losses, right? And it's like, that series absolutely could have gone either way. That was a close six-game series victory for the Maple Leafs. So I just think we need to normalize, like, you can be swept and it can be close. You can lose in seven and it can be a blowout. Or you can get just completely demolished and potentially get swept the way Carolina has to this point. And look, that team needs an infusion of talent. They knew it. I mean, you don't make the second Rantanen trade if you don't take a long, hard look at your team and be like, hey, you know, the aging, like 40-year-old Brent Burns and 33-year-old Dmitry Orlov with Shane Gostisbehere might not be an inner circle contender's top four group.
Yeah.
We might need some work before we're ready. And I think they consciously made that decision, and you're seeing it out. You're seeing it play out now. They're still really well positioned, but obviously it's ugly when, you know, the extent to which you're bludgeoned is this dramatic.
And Sheldon from Surrey texts in. He says, in my opinion, the Oilers and Stars are playing for second place. Florida looks unstoppable and just play a perfect brand to win playoff games. Now, I don't want to do an early Stanley Cup preview here because, as you said, look, the Western Conference.
Yeah, no.
As
Dallas
much as Edmonton is in the driver's seat, it's not done yet. However, I do think as much as we're focusing on Carolina and the blowout and the streak of losing games in the Eastern Conference Finals and the fallout from the Rantanen trade and all of that, the bigger story is what Florida's doing. To me, the bigger story is that they are on the cusp of going to their third straight Stanley Cup final here, and this might be the best they've looked this stretch since Game 5 of the Leafs series might be the best they've looked in this incredibly dominant, incredibly successful three-year run. And I think that's a huge part of the context when you're evaluating what's happening to Carolina. Not that it's an excuse, but I again, and I've made this point on the show last week too, like this whole idea of like, oh, if only the Leafs had got past Florida, they'd be stomping Carolina too. It's like, no, because you got stomped by the Panthers at the end of that series. The last two opponents the Panthers have placed, and by the way, they had a pretty easy time with Tampa as well in the first round, they have absolutely blown them out. It took a while, took a few games to get going against the Leafs, but they've just carried that momentum on. And look, if it's a rematch with Edmonton, Edmonton's going to have home ice. That's a big deal. That's something that could potentially shift the series and change the result from last year. But as interesting as I do find the debate about what Carolina is going to do, all of those things, the big story here is the peak that Florida is hitting and just how impressive it is that they're hitting this peak, considering all the extra extremely tough hockey they've played over the final 3 years. What we're witnessing right now is just absolutely remarkable from them.
Yeah, it is. I think they're going to beat Dallas if it's Dallas. I don't know that they're going to beat Edmonton. And the reason for this is, there is no home ice advantage in hockey like McDavid with last change.
That's a huge change and a huge difference from last year.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't want to, as Sheldon said, well, they're playing for second place. I don't want to write that story just yet because that's a big deal.
I'd add, too, that if you, like, the key with the Panthers, they are vulnerable in two main places, and they are brutally difficult places to punish. But one of them is if you are willing to play through the dangerous areas, if you're willing to try to break out through the middle with stretch passes, outlet passes, the most dangerous variety in high pressure, you can generate against them off the rush. That's what the Maple Leafs found a way to do and did really very well until, obviously, it fell apart on them. The Edmonton Oilers are pretty well suited to doing that, especially with the addition of like Wallman and Klingberg and how those guys are playing. I'd add Troy Stetcher too, just another mobile body back there, steady, solid, really good at having that sort of feel for pressure. Plus, they may get Ekholm back.
Yes.
I think if they get Ekholm back, they got to go 11-7 and take Trent Frederick out of the lineup. Now, you probably don't do that against Florida because you want some of that snarl, but I mean, Trent Frederick might be the least impactful regular in the playoffs.
At least ease Ekholm back in. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, give yourself some insurance.
Yeah, get him up to speed.
Also, Nurse Stetcher might be your third pair once you have Ekholm back, right? Because Ekholm plays with Bouchard. Wallman is your second pair. RD, maybe you play him with Kulak. And I just think Stetcher does such a good job stabilizing Nurse's, you know, up and down instincts, right? Like, Nurse can be awesome, but he can also be a double-edged sword as a player, and I think Stetcher covers for him really well with some of his sort of overall steadiness and the defensive mobility. Anyway, and then the other part of it is you need to punish and win the matchup against the Tkachuk-Bennett-Verhaeghe line, which, good luck, right? Real tough to do, except McDavid ate them for breakfast in the Stanley Cup final last year, right? Like, that is a matchup that is a tough one for Florida because none of those guys are elite skaters. They're good skaters. They're not elite skaters. That's it. When you can put the Barkov Forsling blanket over McDavid, that series looks one way. If Knobloch's able to sick McDavid on the rest of the lineup, that looks very, very different.
Yeah.
So that's 1 through 9, Florida has more good players than anyone else and three top pair caliber defenders. Kudos to them. Bill Zito, masterclass. They do not, however, have 97 and 29.
Yep.
And that's going to be a fascinating dynamic if we do get the rematch that I think we're all hoping for. We're all hoping for it, right?
I don't know about hoping. I think there's a lot of Canucks fans who aren't hoping for it.
Yeah, but they're just like rooting. I mean, are they watching every night?
I assume so.
I don't know, man. I think if you're just like a objective hockey fan, that storyline.
Sure. But fans aren't objective. That's part of the nature of that makes them fans.
Well, you know what I mean? But did they really enjoy hockey, or they really enjoy their Canucks sweaters? Like, come on.
I'm just saying, there's a lot of entertainment value. I think fans would be willing to sacrifice.
I'm talking if you're a hockey
to
fan
to get the Edmonton loss, the Edmonton loss.
I think if you're a hockey fan who supports the Canucks, as opposed to just being a Canucks fan who doesn't really watch every night,
yeah,
then the rematch is what you want to see, and you want to see Edmonton lose it in the most painful way possible.
Yeah, which is probably in the rematch also.
Right.
So there is now.
It's brutal. Can you imagine getting to the summit twice? And
you're
not
always
being
gambling.
Able to,
it's a risk. There's a lot of spice on that one, but
yeah,
it is the most.
Well, you know how I feel about spice.
I do. It is the most painful possible outcome. So there's always something to root for there. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Somebody texted in asking what a list of the most dominant playoff teams of the, I guess maybe the cap era would look like, and how high do the Panthers place in that pantheon of teams. I mean, I think we'll see if they can get another Stanley Cup, but already we assume going to be a third straight Stanley Cup final. And again, just we don't really see teams demolish other really good playoff teams like this too often. So I know you've pointed out the Blackhawks as kind of a similar one in their run, like 2010 to 2015, where they hit some absolutely ridiculous peaks in there. That might be the closest comp for what we're seeing from the Panthers right now.
Yeah, I think so. It's the Carolina Hurricanes have one of the highest gears in hockey, right? But when the Carolina Hurricanes take over a game, they have 30 shots and maybe you're down 1-0.
Yeah.
Whereas when the Panthers do it, it's like, and it's 7-1 going into the second intermission. And it's just like, oh my God, stop. They're already dead. And, you know, the other team with that sort of gear is the Edmonton Oilers, right? And the Edmonton Oilers likewise can just absolutely fillet you when they're, it just looks different a little bit in that. I mean, Edmonton also does it with the zone time, and Edmonton also does it with the weird hunting pucks in the slot. No team is better at just like turning. You better catch those point shots. Like you better get to that puck first. You better box out. You better have position, because between Perry, Hyman, Kane, Dreisaitl, like the way that they use bodies and then quickly make skilled plays, any loose change in the slot is like the Oilers are liable to like huck, but you know, snap it around three times and it's in the back of the net. I mean, they're the best I've ever seen hunting loose pucks in the offensive zone. But really, when Edmonton cooks you, it's off the rush.
All right, before we go to break here, and we're going to chat with Kevin Woodley on the other side, excited to get his thoughts about these two series and what Florida's doing, Stuart Skinner in net for Edmonton, all of that. Before we get there, I did want to just take a moment to say congrats to a couple of Vancouver Canucks, Connor Garland and Drew O'Connor, who win gold with Team USA at the World Championships on the weekend. I still can't believe it's their first one since 1933. You'd think they would have lucked into one at some point there, but now they have it. They have won gold, and Connor Garland in particular played a huge, huge role on that team, one of the offensive leaders for Team USA. And I think it's notable and worth just a minute or two of discussion that Connor Garland having a big moment in the spotlight, right, with a lot of eyes on what he was doing there. And of course, he is eligible for an extension on July 1st. And I know you and I have had the conversation about whether it's Connor Garland, Thatcher Demko, you know, even go down the list to a guy like Teddy Bluger, these players who are going into their final years of their deals, does it make sense to explore trade options for them? And Garland might be the name, as much as the Canucks need that top six offensive juice, and he can be a part of that, considering the fact that he's having had this moment, right, raises his profile a little bit. He's been consistently productive. He's not making that much with where the cap is going right now. I think his trade value would be really significant on the market at the moment. That doesn't mean you have to trade him, but I think as much as we talk about the Thatcher Demko scenario, right, where an extension is difficult, and if you can't get one done, do you have to look at the trade market? I think you can say the exact same thing about Connor Garland. If you don't like what his number is going to be on an extension, don't do the Brock Besser thing and carry him in as a pending unrestricted free agent. I think he's that caliber of player where you kind of got to decide, are you locking him up or are you going to trade him? He's beyond the caliber of like a Teddy Bluger where you say, well, hey, that's just the cost of doing business. We can lose him. He can walk and that's fine. Like Connor Garland's better than that. I think you have to make a decision.
I would add this. No one, if I were ever to say, like, you know, to have an opportunity where a Canucks hockey operations top executive said, what's the number one thing we have to take care of working for the Vancouver Canucks? I would say this. Act as if you cannot make a deal at the deadline. Act as if you cannot sell. Because across four different management groups over the last 15 years, whether they run out of time or they don't like the market, this organization never gets full value at the deadline. I think it's too complicated. I think this organization is too laser focused on winning meaningless games down the stretch. I think it's bone deep. I don't think they're functional working to a deadline. And I don't think that's on Jim Rutherford. Jim Rutherford can work to a deadline. I don't think that's on Patrick Alvin. Patrick Alvin's as organized as they come. He can work to a deadline. I think it's on ownership in the organization itself. Manage your risk. If there is any chance that you may end up holding the bag an hour before the deadline looking for a deal, you should have made that deal in July. Flat out. And we should criticize the organization accordingly. I'm not kidding. Like, Quinn Hughes, we'll take care of that at the... No!
No, you absolutely will not.
Connor Garland, if you won't extend, we'll take care of it at the... We'll see how the season... No!
Yeah.
Must be done now. This organization cannot be trusted at the deadline.
I think Garland and Demko are the two clear examples for me this year. Like, you just have to figure it out.
Yes.
Don't let it hang. They're too good. They would command too much return. Don't let it hang over your heads and be unfinished business going into the season. Figure it out.
Unfinished business. You can embrace the hard too, brother.
That's right. I may or may not have told one of the girls on the baseball team I coached to move their feet at practice.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was like, oh, my goodness. I really am. I really am in the tank for talk it. All right, Kevin Woodley is going to join us momentarily here. Before
is she
we
a
do
wall
that,
guy?
Well, there's not really walls in play as much in baseball, so it doesn't come up as much, but she did need to move her feet. BC Liquor, until May 31st, save $3 on Vintage Ink Whiskey Barrel Aged Red and $5 off Empress 1908 Gin. Visit your nearest BC Liquor location today. Enjoy responsibly. Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. Kevin Woodley next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We're broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors. For over 50 years, visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel offers industry-leading heli forklifts and engineered racking solutions. Visit them online at Rack Steel. And now joining us on the line from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine. In fact, he's joining us on the hotline, powered by Power West Industries. He's a presentation of White Rock Hyundai. He is Kevin Woodley. Woodley, how's it going?
It's going good. It's going good. I just got back from Edmonton last night. I was not there for hockey. I was there for volleyball, but I can say that, not to make anyone in this market feel bad, but the vibes are off the chart in Edmonton right now. And yesterday was one of those days, I think it was 24 degrees. We were walking back into the volleyball venue for my kids' final game. and you could see all the people in the jerseys, and it was just like, man, like, reminded me of going to Seattle a couple of years ago for the playoffs there and being like, I miss this.
Yes.
I want this. And I want it on an annual basis, not once every 10 years.
Yeah, that would sure be nice. And I mean, they've gotten a couple of deep runs now here for Edmonton, and we'll see. I mean, as we were talking in the first segment, like, I don't want to bury Dallas just yet here, but Edmonton with a big chance to take full control of the series tomorrow night. Stuart Skinner, a fascinating talking point throughout these playoffs, right? And the conversation has been about him wildly vacillating from shutouts to getting blown out. Now, he did allow a goal in the most recent game, so it didn't quite fit that mold, but what are you seeing from Stuart Skinner? Are the swings in his performance, is it a little exaggerated by the numbers, or are you seeing this big discrepancy in what he's doing on a game-to-game basis?
No, it's like the discrepancy is in what's happening in front of him.
Yeah.
Like, this is largely environment. And when they get caved in like they did the first couple in LA, and people, like, it's like people have forgotten. Yeah, he lost the job against the Kings. The first game against LA, Edmonton gave up more high danger chances and more expected goals than in any single game of their entire run to the Cup final last year. Like, they didn't defend. They turned pucks over in bad areas. They gave up rush chances, and that has forever been the thing that determine Stuart Skinner's fate. Like, for sure, some of it's him, and he's made some nice adjustments off the rush coming back. He's not taking as much depth. He's not stranding himself, you know, on east-west plays so often. You know, he was sort of the poster child for me this year, where, you know, puck goes in off an east-west lateral off the rush, and the announcers say, oh, the goalie didn't have a chance. And I'm like, no, maybe the goalie didn't give himself a chance. And he's done a nice job making adjustments there, but more than anything, they're not giving them up. Like, they have only given up since started game four against Vegas. So we're now five games played. His second game back against Vegas in the second round. They have given up 10 high danger rush chances in five games played, and only one of those was off an east-west. Only one in five games. Six of them were in game one versus Dallas. Right? So in the other four games, they're averaging one high danger rush chance against the game. That's it. Like, that's it. And so if they defend like that, and this is what got them to the Cup final last year. Great players playing a way that succeeds in the playoffs. They're not, and this is Dallas and Vegas. These are two of the best rush teams in the league. They are giving up nothing off the rush. And if you give him spot-to-spot goaltending, Skinner is more than capable of holding his own. And, you know, at the end of the day, too, not to be the guy that's going to be like, yeah, goaltending doesn't matter, but, like, right now, going into tonight's games, there is only one goalie left who is above expected, and his team is down 3-0 in his series. Freddie Anderton is the only guy left above expected. Bob, slightly below. Ottinger, slightly below. Skinner, slightly below, but guess what? Now past Ottinger. Like, so much of this is what your team identity is and can you play to it in the playoffs, and does a key underlying part of that include not giving up freebies off the rush? That's a big part of this.
With Skinner yesterday, there was a save. I don't know if you remember the sequence, and I'm struggling to remember who sent the original pass. I think it was Rantanen. And it's a east-west pass off sort of a broken rush. And it deflects off Sam Steele and ends up going effectively post-to-post. And Skinner has to scramble across the net. And it looked to me, Woody, like he completely abandoned technique, knowing where he's weak, just to make sure that he got across. And he did make a pretty high difficulty save. Do you remember the sequence I'm talking about?
I was watching volleyball.
I'm going to clip it and send it to you.
Well, I can tell you this. It wasn't high danger because I went through the high danger last night. Like, I did go through a bunch of the clips off ClearSight. Like, I ran through the video clips this morning to watch. Like, to me, it's the fastest way to watch the scoring chances both directions. Sort of.
Maybe it was too deep in.
I wasn't able to watch.
Woody, maybe it was too deep in, but it was a tough save.
Listen, it's hard to tell, too. Like, sometimes for sure, Thomas, it's abandoning technique, but the reality, and this is why creating those types of chances east-west off Stu is sort of how you break him down, how you attack him, is it's always going to look a little unorthodox because he has this narrow butterfly and he's not a great skater laterally. And so in a lot of those situations, it goes to, or he ends up in desperation because he just doesn't have the width or the extension ability without pitching himself forward. So there's a little bit of a lunge, and to get that extension with pads, you know, that extra like 6 to 8 inches of extension when he's moving and he's already down in the butterfly or sliding across or getting to a spot, he just doesn't have that width. And that's where you end up seeing him pitch forward a lot, as we used to call it, the Lou flop in Vancouver, right? Like, it was, everybody thinks it's just about losing your balance, but quite often that pitch forward, if you were to get in a butterfly and stick your leg out as far as you can and you can't get any more, allow your torso to then pitch forward to the ice or try it on your living room floor. Definitely don't do it while driving. Maybe not in the studio, guys. I don't know how clean that floor is. And get into a fully extended butterfly as far as you can, and now allow your torso to pitch forward. And that leg extends like another 6 to 8 inches. So a lot of times when he gets into desperation moments and he gets extended and he gets pulled apart, or he's got to get somewhere quick, there's this sort of lunging element to it where he pitches forward. And quite often, if you put it back against the grain into him, he's not able to extend the pad with a seal along the ice. Like, the knee's off the ice as he lunges, and it can cost him that way. So don't know the one that you have in mind.
It's the Blackwell shot, first period. I'm going to send it to you. I literally just cut it while you were talking so that you can have a look.
The benefit of being somebody who talks a lot, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I
let Woodley keep going while I clip half the
game. I do some video editing.
Yeah. Well, I want your thoughts on it, because I thought it was, I interpret it as a sign of confidence that he is able to play hockey as opposed to worrying about stylistic stuff. To me, that's a goalie in a groove where it's just like, safe selection. This is the right play, whether or not, you know, me and my goalie coach are going to like it on tape afterwards. I just think that's a good sign.
He's, and I agree completely. And the thing is, it's an old Tom Cruise movie, and I'm struggling to remember which
Risky
one
this business
line comes from, but it ain't sexy, but it's got teeth.
Oh, okay.
Right? Like, they're trying to indict somebody on an accounting thing, a technicality, rather than the crime itself. Like, and that, like, there's going to be times where it's ugly for him. But you're right. When he gets into that mode where he's not trying to be perfect technically, where he gets to his spot, but then in the moment needs to abandon it. Now, again, that only works if you have enough defensive structure in front of you that you're not doing it all the time, A. And B, you're one and done in a lot of those situations. Mm. So you better have guys coming back to the front of the net and taking care of any second chance opportunities, because that's where that pitch forward, off balance, really hard for him to sort of continue if that sequence continues into second and third opportunities. So you better make sure that, you know, you better make sure that you can, that you've got the help around you to do that.
Woodley, that point you made, which I think is fascinating, about, you know, the fact that there's only one goalie left here who's above expected, and, you know, his team might go home tonight and hasn't exactly had a stellar showing in the Eastern Conference Finals, but Ottinger, Skinner, and Bobrovsky all slightly below expected goals saved here in the playoffs. Just big picture wise, if you're another NHL team, you know, sitting on the sidelines right now on the outside looking in here, are there lessons to draw from that, or do you see it more as kind of a 1 year statistical quirk?
No, I think we've seen a lot of this of late. Like, and it doesn't mean that they aren't coming up big in big moments.
Yeah.
Like, Jake Ottinger's second round was exceptional. Right? Like, his first round was dead on average. They got through it anyways. And a lot of that is, listen, like, in the first round, I don't think his numbers were fair, Ottinger's in particular, because there were looks that are clear-sighted shots from the edge of the slot or the middle with no dynamic movement. And straight lines, by the book, those are low-danger chances. And so if they go in, you get punished from a statistical standpoint, especially in a small sample like one round of the playoffs, even if it goes seven games. But what's not factored in is the fact that in that series in particular, the guy shooting a bunch of them was someone named McKinnon, right? And so there are guys that will bury those looks, and there are guys that won't. And when you add it all up, the reality is those shots go in such a low percentage of the time that they get classified as low danger. But if you happen to face a guy who has you know, and I should be careful to say that, like, oh, elite finishing talent, and so that should be factored in, because one of the case points that Valiquette made when he was going through this a couple of years ago, he went and looked at all the Austin Matthews shots in straight lines from these shots, and he was, you know, we all know about his sort of, his release, his ability to sort of open up goaltenders and change the point of attack by, that's the way he sort of moves the angle before shooting or while shooting. And yet he was finishing at a low danger clip on these open looks. So, but if guys are feeling it and they're in their moment and they're putting it by your ear, bar down, then you can end up with numbers that, that I don't think tell the full story. So at the end of the day, though, to your point, and it's one I've made many times over with the Canucks, yes, they have to figure out a way to be more dynamic offensively. No argument there, especially from an entertainment perspective. But chances of actually winning or doing anything to me are, and raising the sort of floor for this team, which is something I think Tuck had accomplished comparatively to the, you know, no defense era that preceded him, like that defensive profile is what wins in the playoffs. And how you achieve it, whether it's with, by dominating puck possession at the other end, a lot of it too isn't just, it's not defending. What I'm noticing is a lot of the defending in the playoffs, it's not so much that, yeah, hey, like five guys back and you know, aggressive back check through the neutral zone that allows defensemen to gap up and not have to retreat because they know they have that back pressure all the time. But a lot of it is decision making. Like, it's where you turn the puck over, it's when you turn the puck over and what you do with it. So, you know, sort of having that baked into your identity as a team, I think that matters. Like, you don't see Florida giving up crazy amounts of high danger. And until this round, and I don't have an answer for this one, but until this round, you didn't see Carolina doing it either, right? Like, they were insulating their goaltender. Now, their goaltender up until this round was outperforming it by such a margin that he was easily heads in. Like I said, even after the way this has gone the first couple for Freddie Anderson, still the only guy above expected. But for me, the lesson there is, it's not don't pay guys tons of money or, you know, don't pay your goaltenders. It's more that it doesn't matter if you do, if you don't defend. And you've got Stu Skinner, what, third year as a starter, $2.6 million, and ahead in the series in the Western Conference Final, at the other end, outperforming for now, a guy in Jake Oettinger who's an 8.25 guy. So I think the environment matters more, right? Like, doesn't mean the goaltending doesn't matter. I just think the environment matters more. And Thomas, you're right. That's a broken play across the middle. I probably had a filter wrong that I didn't see this in high danger unless – I'm looking at your replay here. Unless it's the fact that he has to catch it on the backhand, pull it to his forehand, and shoot, which may give that enough time on a lateral that the goalie should be there. Like, so in other words, they frame rate this to measure, you know, there's a time element to this on what is a slot line play and what isn't. And I think it's 0.3 of a second. You have to be off, on and off your stick to qualify as a true lateral one-timer, true slot line play. And so maybe that's why this didn't get tagged, or maybe, like I said, I just had a filter off as I was going through it or missed something. To me, though, this is actually a technical save.
You think so?
And if you look at it...
I also like that you briefly became Christopher Walken there. This is a technical save. I like that. That was awesome.
Listen, I did a lot of screaming this weekend in a conference, expo conference, what, expo center at Edmonton. I think there's a 75 courts. So imagine 75 courts.
Oh my goodness.
With girls playing volleyball on it at all different levels. So screaming above that din, it was kind of like being at, like, I don't know, an NSYNC concert or something. And my voice is kind of gone here. So anyways, back to Christopher Walken breaking down Stuart Skinner, which is a Saturday night skit waiting to happen. If you look at that play coming off the bottom of the right circle, sort of bottom hash there, to me, you're right. This is a confident play for Stuart Skinner, but more confidence in his reads and in the guys around him. Because if you look, he squares up on the initial puck carrier, which means he is squaring up almost to the boards. And so that backdoor chance, despite having a guy in the middle and a backdoor opportunity, only one defenseman between them. He is playing shooter the whole way here. He is totally squared up. If you look at his right skate and he's on his left post, it's barely in the lane of the net. So in other words, he is so squared up on this guy that he's almost taking himself out of the net. And this is almost, to me, goalies, if I were to break this down, knowing that the puck play gets through, I would argue that his squareness to the shooter is at the expense of him being able to get across earlier and in a more clean manner. But goalies know that if this shooter comes off the wall and beats them from below the hash mark, it's not quite a dead angle because he's not down to the bottom of the circle, but that's the one they can't give up. That's the one that sags your bench. And this is still a nothing game midway through the first period. That sharp angle, clean look, if I give that up, everybody's looking at me, but also my bench might lose confidence in me. If I trust my defenseman to take care, I think I can get to the middle net guy with a push and a recovery, and I trust my defenseman to take care of the back door. If that gets through clean and goes in on a one-timer, that's not on me, and nobody's questioning the confidence the team has in the goaltender. And I still give myself a chance, at least, to get across there. Like, I've had this discussion with NHL goalies. Like, there's a psychology to this. When we do our pro reads at Ingle. So I look at this play and he's squared up on this guy from a dead angle. And once he makes the pass, the guy does a nice job of holding and sort of faking shot, which gets Skinner to his knees. That pass goes across clean. There is not a single part of Stuart Skinner's body that is in the net on Blackwell. Not a single piece. Defenseman gets his stick down, pass bounces off the defenseman's stick, which changes the angle, forces Blackwell to catch it on his backhand and go to his forehand. Skinner's got a massive rotation now, because that's the thing about being square to the boards. It's not just that you're not taking up any net if the pass gets through. You now have to completely turn your body. This is why slot line plays were invented as a tracking measure. I have to get to the far post. That is the biggest rotation you can have as a goaltender. And rather than dive across head first, he pulls his right leg in, loads up a butterfly push, and comes across leading with the blocker, leading with vision, skate right into post, ends up in a butterfly, and then just falls forward. So I'm going to go against you on this one. That's a technical save that shows confidence in the team around him versus him going outside of his technique. Like, he actually gets across in a clean butterfly push, leading with the blocker. Still a great save either way. And I think there are elements of this that make it a really fun breakdown, but maybe not in the same reason you're looking at. Like, I actually look at that as more of a technician save. If he goes scramble off the initial drop, he's diving overhead first, trying to maybe get a stick paddle right on it. That's a recovery and a butterfly push in a situation that I would argue he may have even made more difficult for himself by his initial decision, but one that's still completely justifiable with the whole, man, I got to take care of the shooter first. That's my job. That's what my system says. Trust everyone else to do their job. Because as soon as you flatten out so that you cheat that rotation to make sure you can get across, that's when in this league, the guy coming off the wall with his head up picks it over your shoulder or puts it under your blocker, under your blocker side arm, because you're not square to him anymore. And that's the kind that leads to everyone looking at you sideways, even on your own bench.
See, this is why I needed you to watch it. I needed you to correct me.
I'm glad we shared video on this. Everybody on the radio going, what the hell is he talking about?
Yeah, maybe I have to tweet it out.
This should be a TV segment.
A companion. We need a companion video on Twitter.
Yeah.
Woody, just with Jake Oettinger, I thought it was interesting that none of the Oettinger should start in Milan folks brought up that he just got detonated on the road.
Yeah, you're just teeing that one up for me, eh?
It's not criticism of Oettinger. It's just...
No, that's exactly it. And that's why I was actually worried that I went a little too far after the last round, sort of breaking down some of this stuff, because I don't mean to criticize him. Like, he's an exceptional goaltender. He's 26 years old, and this is like, what, three of the last 4 years, or 3 years in a row he's in the conference final? Like...
Yep.
Again, environment matters. And when I look at the proprietary numbers and I look at ClearSight, I've got a goaltender who over the last 3 seasons is basically right around league average. And in the playoffs, again, last round was a heater. But when the environment starts to dissipate defensively, the numbers tend to come down too. And so much like everyone's like, Jake Gottinger over Connor Hellebuck after the second round, just because of that. And with all due respect to your peers at The Athletic, I read a bunch of that there. And I was like, the reality is...
Shots fired Connor at last.
Connor Hellebuck...
I'm telling him.
Connor Hellebuck's environment went from like 903 in the regular season to 870 in the playoffs. Like, that is going to... And I'm not pretending he was good. In the second round, though, and I don't know if I've told you guys this one because I've done a few shows since then. In the second round, Connor Hellebuck's adjusted save percentage was better than his adjusted save percentage for the entire season, for which he's going to win a third Vezina trophy. And this is more of a shot at the entire Professional Hockey Writers Association. He's probably going to win a third, or he's going to win his first Hart trophy. And again, much like me saying the Jake Oettinger stuff, I worry about how this is going to be interpreted and being anti-goalie, but that should, like, and I probably should have maybe broadcast this message before the voting, but this shouldn't be the year. It shouldn't be.
Don't worry. He's not like top of my ballot, Woody.
Okay, good. There you go. But your answer, from what I'm hearing, he's the top of the ballot of a lot of your peers.
Yeah, no, he's the betting favorite.
Where this finishes, because the reality is he had a top three defensive environment this year. And I do think you can make an argument that the confidence he brings to the team allows him to play within their structure and never feel like they have to go outside of it. I don't need to try and block a shot that's not my job because Connor's got that. I just need to do my job. And I think he can be a part of that, and maybe that's part of the Hart discussion. As a goalie guy, I would say that a Hart trophy should be given to the goalie as the MVP every single year, right? But if we're really breaking
down...
That's
why I have to ding them. That's why it's really hard for a goalie to win the Hart for me. Because if I interpreted it literally, I'd have a goalie on top every single season. The reason I didn't vote for Hellebuck ultimately was there wasn't a big enough gap between him and Vasilevsky this year.
Him and Vasilevsky, another one who was in the top three in environment for the entire season.
Right.
Right, like neither guy in the top three in adjusted save percentage. Now, workload, everything they do, goal saved above expected, Connor Hellebuck ended up second to Darcy Kemper, whose environment wasn't as good as everybody thought.
Mm-hmm.
But Vasilevsky was like just flirting around the bottom of the top 10. Right, like, so it's really interesting how, like again, the way these discussions are framed, and especially in the playoffs where hyperbole reigns, right? Like, one goalie beats another goalie, hey, he's no longer the best goalie. You heard it from a lot of the Dallas players about Hellebuck and how they thought of him. But even the players poll, if we believe that players actively think before they fill that out, and I'm not entirely sure they do, sometimes they just go with the narratives themselves. Oh, this guy's always been good.
Yep.
You know, Connor Hellebuck wasn't top this year in terms of the goalie they least wanted to face. So it makes for fascinating times and fascinating discussions. And I'm just here to yell at clouds and bring a little bit of perspective on what some of those numbers actually mean.
Which is the good thing is, as Canadians, you know, I hope they don't start Hellebuck in Milan.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Sounds great.
Well, I mean, the irony is, there are a whole bunch of guys that they could start.
Yes, right. No doubt.
Connor Hellebuck.
Must be nice. Like,
and let's be honest,
Americans
aren't going to have a 900, they're not going to have an 870 expected save percentage in Milan.
Probably not. But we can hope. That would be nice. Woodley, this is a powerhouse hit. We're sending you video clips live. You're breaking them down for us as it happens.
Correcting the record.
Fantastic stuff all around. Thanks for doing this, man.
Hey, my pleasure. Hey, just one quick thing for folks. I know we got to go, but make sure you check out the Sportsnet 650 Twitter account because the Jays Care 50-50 launched today, and I know they've got the Jays Care Celebrity Golf Classic, two really great causes that I would highly encourage people to check out when they have a chance.
Well said. Thank you for that, Woodley. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
That is Kevin Woodley on Sportsnet 650, brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George.
Breaking
in White
down
Rock.
Video, doing reads.
I know, or WhiteRockHyundai.com. Now, more on that in just a second here. BC Liquor, until May 31st, save $3 on Vintage Ink Whiskey Barrel Aged Red and $5 off Empress 1908 Gin. Visit your nearest BC Liquor location today. Enjoy it responsibly. As you just heard from Kevin Woodley, the Jays Care Celebrity Golf Classic is coming up this summer, and We're really excited this year. We are launching the Sportsnet 650 Jays Care 50-50, which is now live. You can buy tickets. You could win half the jackpot here. The other half supports Challenger Baseball, fantastic program that helps kids of all abilities across BC thrive through sport. Tickets start at just $10. You can get bundles for even more chances to win. Don't wait. Get your tickets now at jayscaregolf.rafflenexus.com. That's jayscaregolf.rafflenexus.com. Must be 19 or older and live in BC to play. Let's make a big impact together. And again, this is a fantastic cause. So the Sportsnet 650 Jays Care 50-50 is now live in support of Challenger Baseball. We'll take a break. More on the other side. We got an open segment. Greg Wyshynski joins us at 1:30. But more Canucks talk next on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by your Lower Mainland Boston Pizza. A fast lunch doesn't have to mean fast food. Satisfy your midday cravings by choosing a main, a side, and drink for only $15. Served in 20 minutes or less. Send your texts in 650, 650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. We had one come in from Chet in Burnaby earlier. We were talking about, just briefly, the Connor Garland contract situation, whether he makes sense as a trade chip this summer for the Canucks. And Chet in Burnaby texted in, if you're picking up the phone and talking to Philly about trading them Garland, who are you targeting? Of course, we know the regard that Rick Tocchet has for Connor Garland and that Connor Garland has for Rick Tocchet, the relationship they've had. And I understand why Chet brings that one up. We also know Philly is much more in the market for centers, much like the Canucks are, but it doesn't mean they wouldn't be interested in a player like Connor Garland. I think they just need a talent upgrade generally on that roster. So is there a name that stands out to you as a potential target from the Philadelphia Flyers?
Probably Noah Cates, yeah. RFA this summer. You know, the truth is that I think you're looking at something like Cates Plus as opposed to landing a Tippett or a Konechny, but obviously those guys would be higher
that would
up the
be
order.
Sick.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Travis Konechny? Ooh.
Yeah, or Owen Tippett. I mean, yeah. You know, I think Owen Tippett, like, you like really big guys that can rip it and skate fast? I do. That sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
But I would be shocked. I would just be very, very surprised if one of those guys shook loose, no matter how much Rick Tocchet desires Connor Garland in the room and working with him, right? So that would be my gut instinct on it, like Noah Cates and a third round pick, something like that.
Yeah. Now somebody did text in the Flyers have 3 seconds firsts this year.
Oh, okay.
And two of them are, one's from Colorado, one's from Edmonton, so later in the first round picks. But is a late first round pick, is that crazy value for Connor Garland? I don't feel like it is at this point.
What do you mean by crazy?
Like, is that too high?
I don't think it's too high.
I don't think it's too high. I think that's, like, obviously the team has to be interested in all that, but I think that seems roughly appropriate. And then from the Canucks perspective, well, it would be get that in the door and then package it to go get something else.
Especially if you have he won't be extension eligible when you get the pick, but if you have a handshake agreement,
yeah,
you know, an understanding at least between everybody. Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. Look, Connor Garland's really good. Getting a first round pick for him would be really good. But doesn't feel like a very Canucks-y move, does it?
No. I mean, it doesn't, though, because you're right that trading a player in that scenario for a draft pick does not. But the idea of the two-step process certainly does. You know what I mean? And in both the Bo Horvat and JT Miller trades, the draft pick has gone out the door immediately. So in some ways, you're just doing a smaller version of that deal without, like, the other pieces changing hands, right? Like, without the Filippito and Victor Mancini and Atu Ratu and Anthony Beauvillier parts, because you're not dealing as valuable a player. You're just getting the pick back, and then you can choose to do with that what you will. Like, yeah. So it's not as if it's completely alien to them, but at the same time, you're right. It just also feels like it's not something they want to do for whatever reason.
No, and
having successfully done it basically in the past.
Twice, right?
Yeah.
Two times over to buy defensemen. So yeah, I mean, maybe. Maybe, you know, you get that first and then package it with, you know, two firsts. What can that land you?
Yeah,
I guess maybe. I don't know. I just would be very surprised if this team ended up. I would just be very surprised if this team ended up at any point trading for futures.
The reluctant and also an understandable, I think it's fair to say, reluctance to subtract from the roster, especially at forward, when you're so desperate for scoring punch and offensive upside, right? And so I do get that. That's a difficult thing to do when you got to have the confidence that whatever you get back is going to help you. Yeah, you might take a step back on paper when you do if you trade Connor Garland. You got to have the confidence that you're going to be able to find a replacement that's going to then help you take a couple of steps forward. That's difficult to do. So I do understand it, why you would be hesitant of shipping out a player who has been one of your most consistent play drivers and offensive producers over the last few seasons. Hank the Tank texted in, hey, Thomas and Jamie, what are you hearing about who the Canucks are targeting in the draft regarding the 15th? What specific players would need to be available at that spot for the Canucks to value making the pick over trading it away? I don't think we're late enough in the process yet to really start getting the, oh, I hear the Canucks really like this guy, or, you know, they're really interested in this player. I will say, though, they had their scouting meetings last week, right? Mm-hmm. So we are in kind of the zone now where I would be on kind of high alert for whether it's who they're taking with the 15th overall or specific players on the trade market, specific UFAs, all of those things. We are now into the part of the calendar having had those meetings where it wouldn't shock me if we start to hear some specific names of any variety, draft, free agent, whatever, start to come out over the next week or so.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we might hear some begin, but like we never heard Jake DeBrusk.
No.
You know, it's not like that name was front and center in people's minds as that sort of process unfolded. So
Volander very much was.
Volander. Well, the draft stuff we tend to be able to get.
Yeah.
Specifically me. But the truth is that I don't expect the Canucks to make their pick.
Yeah, that's the thing.
To be totally honest with you, not that they couldn't possibly, I just am not counting on it. It's not something I expect at this point. It's something that could happen, you know, like it could happen, especially if the draft board looks a certain way potentially. But no, I mean, I think they're going to trade that first because what? They have to move something.
That's the thing.
You can't get anything for free.
No. And if it's like you're not willing to subtract from the roster and you're taking a fair number of your young prospects off the board, like you're only the list of interesting assets dwindles pretty quickly. You have to be willing to move something. The draft pick is one that certainly makes a lot of sense. Now, draft picks could also be involved in another type of acquisition other than a trade, and that's one that you focused on in your latest piece at The Athletic today, which is potential RFA targets. And of course, there's been a lot of conversation really since, what was it, August last year when the St. Louis Blues did the Dylan Holloway and Philip Broberg double RFA move, offer sheet move on the Edmonton Oilers, and we see how that worked out and the instant impact those players had for St. Louis this year. I think there's since that moment, there's been a lot of curiosity about, okay, is this the start of a new era of RFA reality in the NHL where offer sheets are a legitimate, frequently used tool? Not that every team's going to do them every year, right? But more a regular part of the toolbox for general managers. We'll see if that becomes the case. I'm always a little bit skeptical. And I think there's forces cutting both ways here right now. On the one hand, you have a relatively weak UFA market. So does that force teams to get more creative and be more willing to consider going the offer sheet route? On the other hand, so many teams have so much cap space that I think it's going to be harder to really put teams in a bind where they feel like they don't have the choice of matching on a certain player. So I think you could see things go either way. But when you're a team in the position like the Canucks, and it's all about trying to find that talent, and you know it's probably not happening on the UFA market, you have to, I think, be willing to at least do the thought experiment, go through the list, try to game out some of the different targets, just because it's going to be so difficult to acquire guys who can move the needle, guys who can make a difference in the more traditional paths.
Yeah, no, this comes back to what we discussed sort of last week, right? The idea that more than anything else, the Canucks just need to add the best possible player, right? And man, So I've been thinking a little bit about, especially watching these playoffs, the like Matt Duchene of it all, as an example, right? The, you know, idea that Duchene's business decision here is going to be fascinating to monitor, in part because what he is going to be looking at here in terms of just balancing, like, clearly, given his decision to leave Ottawa, right, sign in Nashville, and then after he was bought out, sign and remain in Texas. Like, you know, we all know he loves country music and owns an impressive collection of cowboy hats. Like, I don't think that guy wants to work north of the 49th parallel, all things being equal. And yet, he's 34. And for a 34-year-old player who's done really well, right? He's, I think he's double dipping still, getting paid for the buyout and getting paid on his new contract.
Love that. The dream.
It's his second consecutive $3 million one-year deal with the Stars. But, you know, he's been chasing a cup and living somewhere he's comfortable. And now kind of the gravy train maybe stops. At the very least, his agent's going to sit him down and explain the following to him. If you sign a contract now, the 35-plus rule does not apply to you. If you sign a contract next year, the 35-plus rule applies to you. And the 35-plus rule means that, you know, even if the player retires or something happens, that cap hit remains on the books. Teams are not going to sign a 35-year-old plus, a 35-plus contract to massive term, right? So you can't do another $3 million deal with Dallas and then be like, okay, time to cash in. It's like now or never. You need term. You need a commitment. This is your last chance to get the big payday. And any sensible businessman, I think, would then go out and take the best contract they can find. I'd be pretty nervous if it was the Canucks giving him that contract. Personally, and I think for good reason. He's sick. He's still an elite skater, especially like his short area speed. His short area burst is still as good as it gets. Coming off the wall, attacking into the slot, in zone, his speed still plays and then some. And I like that a lot. The Canucks could use that. He can play center. He can play wing. You know, we talked about the Ray Whitney thing, right?
Yes.
Hard to come up with a better Ray Whitney analogy than Matt Duchene. And yet, you know, is that enough? Is that enough for the Canucks? And I think where I sort of keep coming back to is yes, because he's no worse than the fifth best player available on the market. You know what I mean? Like, it's not going to make people as excited as landing a Mitch Marner or Nikolai Ehlers, but like he's 50-50 to outproduce Nikolai Ehlers.
Absolutely.
Next season.
Yeah.
Like there's a world where he's a better player than Nikolai Ehlers. I don't think so, but like it's at least within the range of outcomes, right?
Yeah, absolutely it is.
And so I just kind of think that what this organization's going to have to do, you know, we talk about getting creative and oftentimes people think of that as like trades.
Yeah.
I don't know why my voice cracked there. Trades. And it can be. They can be trades. But also, it can be reading through and sifting the market a specific way, right? So that you land the guy an arbitrage opportunity, effectively, who's actually more valuable than popular perception would indicate. And that guy might be Matt Duchene.
Yeah. I still just feel like, for as you said, what is he, the fifth best player on the market? So, you know, at least, and that's assuming Sam Bennett gets to the market, right? So would you say if Sam Bennett doesn't, he's the fourth best player on the market potentially?
Yeah, I think so.
And there's going, well, like, it has to be a world where he's a home run contract you're giving him to win the bidding.
Is there not a world where he's a better player than Matt Duchene? Or Sam Bennett?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I don't know, because here's the other thing that I think is going to be fascinating to watch play out is, how to what extent do you think the Florida Panthers experience and the success that they've had as this, you know, hard scrabble playing right on the line physical group, to what extent does that inflate the perceived value of whatever player meets that description.
Massively.
Massively.
Absolutely massively. And Sam Bennett is obviously the poster boy for that because he's not just like a guy who's theoretical about it. He's been doing it. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it inflates his value the most.
A guy like Will Cooley in New York, right? Could he get a massive offer sheet that blows our mind?
Yeah.
Matthew
Nyes is the obvious.
But there's also a sort of corollary there too, where it's like, could a guy like Dakota Joshua see his trade value spike? And is that something the Canucks should consider, even if we all believe that he'll bounce back and believe that he's a useful player for this team?
That, to me, that exactly falls under the rubric of get creative, right? So, okay, hey, we have to look at the which way the tides are going in the NHL, and is there anything we can lean into there? I think the other part of it is there an element of you have to zig when other people are zagging at a certain point?
Right.
And to bring it back to Marco Rossi, he is the player that... If NHL teams are buying into the Florida model, Marco Rossi is the type of player that they're not going to be as high on, right? Because he doesn't have the elite physical attributes, either in speed or size. He's not a soft player or anything like that. He goes to the dirty areas, but it's still a different thing. Because you're dealing with relatively limited assets, relatively limited cap space even, although you do have some relative to the rest of the league, do you almost have to pursue guys that are a little out of step with what the rest of the NHL is going after? Right. You know what I mean? To try to find that talent and then worry about adding those other things around the margins. But if you're playing in the same market where that everyone else agrees, okay, yeah, these are the players we value, those prices, whether it's contract or assets, are going to be massively driven up. So you might have to be forced to be considered like Marco Rossi, yeah, he's undersized, but we really like the talent. That might be the only way to get the amount of work done that they need to do this offseason.
Right. And I just think more than anything, and this is sort of where, you know, my like big picture criticism of this hockey operations administration dovetails, right? Like my fundamental line of criticism has always been, well, that this team needs to rebuild because there's not enough good players. But more than that, that the situation that they inherited, and by the way, I'm already beginning to see some, because of how badly this season went, and because of like Miller, Horvat, Lindholm all gone, and now the Canucks need a set, I'm now beginning to like get comments on my articles or see this conversation online that's like, given what Rutherford and Alvin inherited, and I want to do a big picture criticism of this administration, but I have to say like,
oh, you mean like in a good sense? Like, oh, they inherited all this amazing stuff.
Yeah. And it's like they inherited a sinking ship and did an impressive job patching it over, like better than I would have expected them to be capable
until all of the patches burst at once. Yeah. Well, which is like, again, it's not necessarily their fault.
No, it's not necessarily their fault, but it did happen. And the... Yeah, it did burst at once.
It really did.
But I still think they got further along the path than I would have anticipated. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't think it was possible for them to hit a point where they had this much, like, as clear a path to actually making a run as they did last season. You know what I mean? Like, not this past season, the season prior, 2023-24. And I still think when you look at, like, how much the books have been cleaned up, you know, on and on, they've actually done a reasonable job. The problem, though, is they effectively tried a conventional solution to a problem that I think had no conventional solution, right? Like their approach was basically to focus on hockey fit rigorously and to hire sort of this culture setting coach who could find a way to play that would get more out of the players than the sum of its parts, and to try and effectively graft like depth around an elite group and support that elite group to become the absolute best versions of themselves. Unfortunately, it's the elite group that blew up, right? Demko got hurt. Pettersson, we don't even know what happened.
Yep.
JT Miller, I don't know. I don't even know.
Who knows how to characterize it?
Yeah, it didn't
work.
There
was a rift.
There was a rift. Oh, my God. I mean, whatever. Combustible. It was a combustible group, as it turned out, despite Quinn Hughes hitting his 99th percentile outcome. And so I still sort of think that, like, you know, we're talking about all the ways to be creative and all the ways to find value. It's like we're having the same conversation. There's still no straightforward, practical solution that's conventional here, right? And yet this front office has behaved thoroughly conventionally in approaching any number of, you know, different problems that they've encountered. They've done it really well. You know, if they'd taken over in 2020, I think we'd be talking about a very different team. But they didn't. They took over after more damage had been done. And now, I think once again, it's just like a conventional approach to this offseason, going out and signing a Matt Duchene and trading for another forward. Like, you're still going to be like five good players shy of a Florida Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, your ceiling outcome probably is Adam Foote ends up being your answer to Rod Brind'Amour, and you reach a point in the playoffs, you hit your ceiling, and it's just very clear you don't have the horses.
Yeah, and then you're back to the elite talent conversation, right? To try to find the horses. And we got to go to break here in just a second, but somebody texted in, you know, Florida didn't pay top dollar for their roster. It was all buy low, other than maybe a couple of guys. The Canucks need to create a great environment.
That's not true. They paid full freight for Matthew Tkachuk.
And you said other than maybe a couple of guys, but there's been a lot of buyers.
That's a huge... Sure. They traded the NHL's third leading scorer
defenseman. But there has been a lot of really effective buy low from Florida as well. Obviously, Bennett, Reinhardt.
There has, except you'll find people being like, 2 seconds for a guy in Sam Bennett who's never hit 40 points. Like, that was out there. Sam Bennett was not a cinch.
No, sure, but that's kind of my point, is it wasn't a cinch.
Yeah.
It was taking a chance on a guy and putting him in the right role, right?
Sure.
And Gustav Forsling, right? That wasn't a cinch, but they made it work. And this guy says, you know, create that environment where you can do that and bring the guys in, they'll thrive. But, like, that's a going back to square one thing. To create that environment, which doesn't mean the texter's wrong. It's just that's not something you're going to do in the short term. That, you know what I mean? Like, that's something that you hope to achieve through a rebuild, through resetting the culture, through all of those different things. And they might come to the point where that's the only option left to them. But as much sense as that makes, and I think it's absolutely right, it's also not a short or medium term solution for the predicament that the Canucks find themselves in right now. Okay, before we go to break here, we got to do one to watch, brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. And it's the Florida Panthers looking to complete the sweep tonight in dominant fashion against the Carolina Hurricanes. I feel like I'm running out of people to highlight from the Florida Panthers. And, you know, I was like, Nico Mikkola, he's out tonight. They're resting a bunch of guys who are day to day. I think Sam Reinhart is out again. I've used Sam Bennett. I was tempted to go with like Uvis Balinski's because he's coming in on the back end for Florida. But I feel like I haven't said,
surely we can do better than that.
Well, I'm more to illustrate just like the insane depth and how, what a finely tuned machine they are right now. But I'll go Sasha Barkov because he is still a phenomenal player. We haven't talked about him a lot so much. It's all been about Florida's depth scoring, how balanced it is and all of that. But chance to get the team some rest, chance to put a stamp and an exclamation point on an absolutely dominant performance in the Eastern Conference Final. I'm looking for Sasha Barkov to show up big, the captain for his team in Florida tonight. That's one to watch, brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. It's time to put on your Toyo tires, whether you drive a car, light truck, or van. Toyo tires are designed to perform in all kinds of conditions. Visit Delaney's OK Tire in Langley and Aldergrove. Greg Wyshynski joins us next to wrap up the show here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by your Lower Mainland Boston Pizza. A fast lunch doesn't have to mean fast food. Satisfy your midday cravings by choosing a main, side, and drink for only $15 served in 20 minutes or less. Guests on Sportsnet 650 call in on the hotline powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on. And now joining us on the Power West hotline from ESPN, he is Greg Wyshynski. Wish, what's going on, man?
Oh, it's going. You know, it's either going to be an annoying delaying of the inevitable or a sweep tonight. So it's like one of those situations.
I don't feel like we're going to see a dead cat bounce here from Carolina. You never know, obviously, in one game, but it feels like, man, everyone is just going to want to wrap this up as quickly as possible here. Is this series and what we've seen through three games, does it tell us more about Carolina and their, you know, problems once they get this deep into the playoffs? Or does it tell us more about just how good Florida is playing right now?
Just how good Florida is playing. And I think that's really been the thing for Carolina in the playoffs in multiple seasons. They kind of have the same situation that the Leafs face in some ways of just coming up against really good teams, really good goaltenders. You look at the teams that have beaten Carolina during the Brod Brindamore era, and it's like, yeah, they lost two series to Igor Shesterkin, and yeah, they're going to lose two to the Florida Panthers, who are going to, you know, make this the Cup final 3 years straight. So, I mean, that happens, and Carolina can maybe be a little bit of introspective a little bit about, hey, would things have been different if we hung on to Rantanen and rented him? I don't know. But ultimately, I think this Carolina team probably was entering a bit of a reload era anyway, given the age of some of their players, and that's fine. They've got good young players coming through. They got a lot of cap space and picks they could trade. They're going to be fine. I think it says plenty about the Panthers, and what I find really interesting in talking to some colleagues on other series, I was speaking to my friend Emily Kaplan just a couple hours ago, actually. I feel like everyone covering the Panther series is convinced they're an unstoppable steamroller that's going to win another cup. And I feel like everyone now covering the Edmonton series is like, no, that's an unstoppable steamroller that's probably going to win the cup. If it ends up being those two teams, and I'm not counting Dallas out yet, it's just very interesting how convinced people are about both of those teams, depending on which series they're watching.
Yeah, and especially because it will be a rematch. If it does play out like that, it's going to be fascinating. Before we move on from the Eastern Conference Final, though, how much time do you have for this idea that I've started to see crop up out of Toronto, that this should make Leafs fans feel better about them going to seven against Florida? Like, see, oh, look what they're doing to Carolina. Doesn't that put our performance and our disappointment in a different light? How much time do you have for that idea?
I think I do. I mean, they're a really good team. I mean, maybe it's just that they finally found their stride, later on in the Toronto series. And I also think that game six loss at home against the Leafs was sort of maybe a mile post marker on their journey back to the Cup final, in the sense of, despite all of the eliminations that they've handed out, and despite the Oilers coming back on them, they still couldn't close out that series when given a chance on home ice. And I think that was a teachable moment. I mean, they're just really well built. They play within themselves. They know what their identity is. I think it took a little bit of time for Bob to really find his game in the postseason, and I'm not going to relitigate the Bobrovsky postseason thing with you.
You're not going to
time, Durant.
Why wouldn't you just capitulate? There's nothing to relitigate. There's only capitulation, my friend.
But I also think that it's a case of, like, you know, as the playoffs have gone on, as I wrote about today, you know, the Marchand Verhaeghe, the Verhaeghe Tkachuk Bennett line really has formed a impressive trio. I think Marchand's line has been great, you know, and then, you know, they lose Reinhardt, they plug in Boqvist, and that goes well. I think it took a little bit of time for them to coalesce. It took a little time for Bob to get to his game. And then, you know, once they did, they've looked as good as they have in the series.
Yeah, Matthew Tkachuk looks like he's rounding into form after maybe he was a little bit hurt earlier in the playoffs, just from the eye test anyway. We know that obviously he dealt with some injuries over the course of this year, including in a critical game for your nation. Yeah, I think more than anything, Wish, when I really think about it, it makes sense that Americans such as yourself have such bad goalie takes, given the Ottinger-Hellebuck conversation.
Do you mean in the sense that there's people saying Ottinger should play?
Yeah, and weirdly, none of those people talked about him getting lit up on the road last night. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, he got lit up on the road because his team was giving up, I mean, point blank chances to Zach Hyman and McDavid scored, and then they scored a garbage power play goal. I mean, he wasn't the reason they lost. I mean, the final score was pretty bloated. But I mean, as far as his Olympic stuff, I mean, I think it was an interesting conversation to have when he was playing well and Hellebuck wasn't in the previous round. But my Hellebuck take remains that if you put him behind an all-star team and not the Winnipeg Jets, he's fine. Like, he was fine in Four Nations. There was no problem with Connor Hellebuck in Four Nations, and he'll be fine in the Olympics when he's playing in back of, you know, the best American players versus Neil Pionk.
Jacob Slavin and, yeah,
Neil
Brock
Pionk's
Faber.
Not one of the best American players.
He's not good enough to be on our team, baby. Maybe you want him?
By the way, I love that you said you weren't going to relitigate the Bobrovsky thing, so Drance found another, like, random goalie thing to argue with you. He was like, well, I've got another bone to pick for some reason about Jake Oettinger.
We can relitigate it when the Panthers repeat and he gets the Conn Smythe, then we can have that conversation again.
In what world, though? Like, what are the odds, actually? I need to check the futures betting odds. But in what world, like, what do you have to be watching at this point to even say that sentence?
For Bob?
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy. When there's a...
Wow, he's the favorite on that team. He's like their 10th most important player, Wish. This is mania. This is a mania.
On what? I can't believe you're trying to Chris Osgood, Sergei Bobrovsky.
He deserves it.
On what planet is he the 10th most important player on the Panthers?
On the planet where they have eight top line caliber forwards and also Gustav Forsling and Seth Jones and Aaron Ekblad. They'd be perfect.
You're insane. But if you let me answer the question.
Sure.
The way that a goalie can win the Conn Smythe is when there are several different candidates at forward and none of them.
When their team is too
through.
Good.
I mean, the one guy, the two guys that you're probably looking at forward right now are probably Bennett and Barkov, you know, again. But then
Barkov's 8-1. Bobrovsky's 2.1-1 to win the Conn Smythe. There is no explanation of that gap. I'm sorry, Wish. It is a mania.
I think, not to put words in your mouth, Wish, but I think what you're saying is there's like almost an element where the goalie's the default.
Man,
If no one has pulled away, right? It's like, well, the goalie won a bunch of games, so no one else has an overwhelming case, so we're going to vote for him.
That's exactly what I'm trying to say.
There we go.
I don't know what's happening over here with... with Caesar Sportsbook over here throwing numbers at me. I'm just trying to tell you how the voting usually works in the real world.
Yeah, I'm shocked. I'm stunned that Bobrovsky favorite among the Panthers players.
That's because you're three years on with the Panthers could win with an empty net, which is insane.
Well,
I mean, it shows you don't watch the games, first of all. And
sorry,
of all,
it's the 10th straight year of Bobrovsky's time there getting outperformed by his backup. You don't think they could have won last year with Anthony Stolarz? Come on.
No, I don't.
Really?
I don't.
Really?
Yeah. I really don't.
Okay. Well, Anthony Stolarz was only better than him again this year.
I think Sergei Bobrovsky...
Panthers players know how good he is. That's why they took him out.
the station should get its license revoked for a take that says that Sergei Bobrovsky is a liability for the Florida Panthers.
We did so well.
Below expected.
We did so well on not relitigating it.
Pick
5 minutes.
You have a bone to pick with Kevin Woodley as well, by the way, and Valakat, and the fact that, anyway, let's move on. So you're on the Oilers series, right?
No, I'm in Fort Lauderdale right now.
Okay, good. So do you think then that Edmonton has no answer? Like, if they win tonight and get 11 days off, Wish, will you heavily favor the Panthers, regardless of who their opponent is in the Stanley Cup final?
I think I'd probably do that anyway. I mean, they're so good at everything. They're good offensively. You know, their best offensive players can also punch you in the mouth, which is something that other teams can't do. I think the thing for me is that I do think I picked Dallas to win the cup, but I that could still happen, but I do think fundamentally the Panthers are a better team than Dallas.
Yep.
And I think when they play the Oilers, they can do something that Dallas is extremely struggling with right now, which is planting any sort of seed of doubt in their opponent. Like, they'll make life uncomfortable for Stuart Skinner in a way that Dallas hasn't. And they certainly are going to make life uncomfortable for Draisaitl and McDavid in ways that Dallas hasn't. So I think that's part of the equation too, is the things that the Panthers are really good at, play into them facing either of the teams in the Western Conference.
So I have a sort of pet theory about this, which is that it comes down to home ice. Like, I don't really believe that Florida has a good answer for McDavid when the Oilers have home ice, because obviously at home you're able to sort of blanket him with Barkov and Forsling, which is the most oppressive duo that you can sick on any offensive player in hockey. And we saw, think about games 5 and 7 of the Stanley Cup final last year and how decisive that felt versus what game 6 looked like, where McDavid was unleashed against, second and third pairs and second and third lines. I think the home ice advantage edge, if it's Edmonton, if it's Florida, I'll be favoring Dallas. Or sorry, if it's Dallas, I'll be favoring Florida. But I think Edmonton with home ice is a totally different proposition for this Panthers team.
It does. It impacts everything from to the idea that if it does go to 7 again, then it becomes a game 7 in Edmonton, which is a really chaotic environment. I will say, though, that one of the things that's changed a bit, presuming he's healthy and he's not playing tonight, but we'll see where it goes, is I think Nico Mikkola is a lot better than he was last year. And I think his pairing with Seth Jones has been really good for them. Mm-hmm. So they do have a pretty good second pairing. I haven't looked at the numbers vis-a-vis what it looks like versus their second pairing last year. But I do think that in watching this team now for a couple rounds, assuming Mikkola is going to be all right, and he hasn't separated his shoulder, I think that pairing is one they could put out on the road and not be completely distrustful of it.
For Dallas, and a lot of people around the NHL seem like we're looking forward to the rematch already, but it is still only a 2-1 series between Dallas and Edmonton. What do they need to change? What do they need to improve to extend that series and give themselves a chance?
From a sort of ethereal point of view, again, they've got to put a scintilla of doubt in their opponent. I mean, Skinner's playing with confidence. The Oilers don't really feel like I think they're in any trouble right now. And nor should they with the way that they've played a 5-on-5. And that's really from a more tactical standpoint, that's really the key right now, is they've got to figure out a way to play a little bit better at evens. Because even in the game that they won in game 1, that was an overwhelming advantage for Edmonton. So it's sort of, they're in the same boat as Carolina right now, where Carolina's looking at the second period of game 3 and being like, all right, if we can bottle that, then we're going to be all right. And I think Dallas is probably thinking the same thing about their second period in game 3, which is that if we can find a way to do that all the time, and then not get down 2-0 in the first period, I think we'll be all right.
Where does Carolina go from here, Wish?
I think they're fine. They've gotten their young defensemen a little bit of time to get their feet wet in the playoffs, and both Morrow and Nikishin are going to be really good. I famously picked this team to miss the playoffs because I thought it would be a transition year for them. So I think making the conference final, maybe it's expected given the opponents that they had in the first 2 rounds, but I think it's kind of a gravy season for them, because I sort of feel like this is Eric Tulsky hasn't necessarily put his stamp on the team yet. Maybe things are different if the Rantanen thing had worked out versus, what happened with it. But to me, it was always going to be the next few years are going to be them churning a little bit, Orloff and Burns off your blue line, and, some of the veteran forwards probably off out of your bottom six. I just feel like they're in a transitionary period. And, I guess the caveat there is maybe they get psychotic for having now lost 16 straight conference finals if they lose tonight. But I think if you're taking a rational look at it, given their cap space, given some of the young players on the roster, the ones in the pipeline, and given the picks that they could trade to bolster the roster, I think they're fine. I wouldn't overreact to this at all if I was them.
They also just feel like the team in the NHL least likely to overreact, even to a really ugly performance like this.
I mean, look at the Rantanen situation, right? How many other teams would have just lost their minds and instead, they did the difficult thing, which is, trading him again, and they end up getting Stankoven, who's been arguably their best forward in the playoffs, or at least in the series. And then they get a bunch of picks for him. So, Yeah, I don't think that they're going to be overreactive. Again, like, as bad as this is going to look, and if they go out tonight, it's embarrassing for sure. I still think they can run it back, and I still think that in some ways it's a franchise on the upswing.
Do you think it matters for them to just get one? Like, just put the streak to bed at the very least before you bow out?
I know it matters to Tom Dundon because he gets another home date of playoff revenue. that's a pretty, pretty important thing.
Yeah. But I mean, I mean, in terms of like the next time they're here, you know, the benefit of not having you or I sidle up and say, so 16 in a row, huh? is there an edge to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, undoubtedly, especially because the 8 games of that streak will have come with pretty much the same group. And I mean, you know, when we first started talking about that at the beginning of the series, and then, you know, Jacob Slavin could hand wave away, well, how many of those was I here for? And I'm like, you know, it does have a point. Shouldn't we be like mad at Joe Corvo versus Jacob Slavin for all of this?
The 2009 one is laying it on a little thick. You know what I mean? That's a totally different thing than the Brind'Amour era.
But at the same, I mean, but how unfair is it versus bringing up 67?
Yeah,
if you're on the Leafs. I mean, it's history's history, and pressure is pressure, and results are results, and so they're going to carry that with them. So I mean, you're not wrong in the sense of if you break the streak, it's at least maybe one less pressure point the next time they get here. And again, delusionally, they still think that they have a chance in the series too. So and who knows? I mean, you know, Freddie has a good game, and you know, they're missing a bunch of guys in the lineup. Who knows when they come back? But, you know, it's hard to ever
write. Yeah, you're shooting on Bobrovsky.
All right.
A 3-0.
That's our cue to wrap here.
Sorry, what? A 3-0 lead can become a game 7 pretty quick when you're shooting on Bobrovsky, right, Wish?
Yeah, sure.
All right,
Wish. I'm not even playing these Ranger games with you anymore.
All right. Thank you for doing this, man. I guess as long as the Panthers keep going on these deep runs, we might have to keep relitigating it, but we appreciate it.
We will not have to relive it.
Thanks, Wish. That is Greg Wyshynski from ESPN. We avoided it there for a second. I forgot about it until he brought it up. But then we dove right into it. You don't hear someone drop a reindeer games reference very often.
I think he was actually mad.
You have that effect on people sometimes.
Sometimes.
I'm not sure I'll be able to book him again.
I think you're right.
Just wait until Drance is on vacation. I need a guest.
I'll send an apology.
What does Vegas say about the odds of that happening?
Okay, before we wrap up the show here, I want to mention once again that right in a matter of mere minutes, less than 10 minutes now, on the station, you're going to hear the Abbotsford Canucks playing a winner-take-all Game 5, winner-go-home with the series on the line game against the Colorado Eagles in Colorado for the chance to advance to the Western Conference Finals in the Calder Cup playoffs. So that's coming up. Brandon Astle will have the call here, and I noticed on Twitter he was putting out that the Abbey Canucks shuffling their lineup a little bit. Kirill Kudryavsev and Ty Glover will draw in per Astle for Danila Klimovic and Akito Hirosin. He says looks like the forward lines are getting a shakeup as well. So Manny Malhotra, of course, coach of the Abbotsford Canucks, juggling things a little bit. We'll see what answers he has as they try to extend their run in the Calder Cup playoffs. But I will say, no matter what happens in this game, and of course you want them to go on as deep a run as possible, you want them to win the Calder Cup for the experience it gives all the players. One of the things I said going into the Calder Cup playoffs was the nature of the format is so weird. You could be done. I mean, you can be done in 2 games in the Calder Cup playoffs, right? And then there's a couple of best of 5s to get through. So you can be a really hyped, excited team going into the AHL playoffs, and then it can all end really, really quickly. They've avoided that. And I think that is a credit to Manny Malhotra to have gotten them this far, where it goes from, instead of being a blip or a disappointment, I think you can now look at what the Abbotsford Canucks have done and say, that was a really valuable experience. Of course, you want it to keep going. You want them to keep pressing forward and get even more experience, but I think it's fair to say already a successful Calder Cup playoff performance from Manny Malhotra and his team, the Abbotsford Canucks.
Yeah, I mean, Malhotra has been a revelation over the course of the season, without question. This game coming up tonight, it doesn't matter from the perspective of changing how we talk about and look at Malhotra's season.
No, or the whole team season.
No,
that's what I'm pointing. It's like it's already a success. They've checked the box.
This is gravy.
They avoided the, like, you know, dispiriting, anticlimactic 2 or 3 game exit in the first round or anything like that. Like, it's been a legitimate run. It's given people a chance to get invested in the team, learn more about the players, you know, see at least a sample, a decent sample of what these guys are doing in a playoff environment. So again, not writing it off or anything like that. You certainly hope they can keep it going, and it's a best of 7 in the next round if they are able to keep it going. So that's a big deal, right? You get a big chunk more of games, but they've definitely already checked that box. But here's hoping they can find a way to get it done in Colorado and go on to the Western Conference Finals. Because as you said, it's been the bright spot, is it fair to say, in the Canucks organization this year? The Abbotsford Canucks? Oh, like, well, the number one bright spot?
Well, I mean... like up there with Kiefer Sherwood's hits, record,
hits record, yeah.
And what else do we got?
DPD. I mean, he's part of the Abbey Canucks story.
Well, Karamaki played well too, yeah. Right? I mean, there's been some nice development stories. So no, I mean,
but those are connected to the Abbey Canucks as well, yeah. Right? That's so part of the same story. In
you've
a,
got
in a lot of ways.
Lankinen,
yeah, that's up there.
It's a pretty big positive.
Yep.
You still have Quinn Hughes.
He's still employed by the team. That's always a good thing.
We get to look forward to watching him in Canucks colors in October.
Yep. All right.
New
that's
seats.
The
Don't
show.
Forget about new seats.
So true. All right. That's the show. As I mentioned, Brandon Astle coming up here with the call. Game 5 between the Abbotsford Canucks and the Colorado Eagles. That's next here on Sportsnet 650.
I'm not a big cruise ship guy, I will say, because, again, I don't like being confined.
You can't keep me cooped up in here, okay? I am a peacock. You gotta let me fly.